Night on Arena with me, Ciara King. This week's film reviews, how imagining conversations with her late mother helped filmmaker Carmel Winters, and the latest book by Slow Horses author Mick Herron. And as always, you can contact the show on 51551. You can email us to arena@rte.ie. And we're on Insta at @RTE_arena. Now, tonight on Arena's film reviews, two trips down memory lane and one trip down Stephen King's most horrifying road. Downton Abbey is back for a threequel, and it's the first return since the death of Maggie Smith, who, of course, played the scene-stealing Dowager Duchess with such vim and vigour. But Downton's not the only British institution reinventing itself. The mockumentary daddy of them all, Spinal Tap, is back for round two. And yes, obviously, the amps still go to 11. And Stephen King remains the most adaptable of writers, with yet another of his stories making the leap from the page to the screen. This time it's The Long Walk, written in the 1960s, but which predicts the insidious draw of reality television. We see desperate young men pitted against each other in a competition to be the one survivor. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark have been to the cinema for us, and they join me now. It's lovely to have you in studio.
Hello.
We're going to start with Downton Abbey 3, the grand finale, which sees Hugh Bonneville's Lord Grantham railing against the tide of modernity and having to make some tough financial choices about his multiple homes. God love him. Donald, the times, they are a-changing.
I suppose they are, yes. I'd seen both the previous films of in the big screen versions of Downton Abbey and various episodes down through the years, as you do. And so I hadn't expected this to be good, but I'd expected the kind of the forelock tugging, car toying reactionary nostalgia, which you do get in this. That was in all the previous episodes, and I'd expected the dishonest, unconvincing argument that all this polite serfhood is justified if you have a benevolent czar. But I hadn't expected to be quite so lazy and bad. I mean, it's just dreadful. I mean, there is a real sense here of like end of school, that like, you know, we're in here playing games rather than doing this properly. And once we've finished this day and got through these 90 minutes, mm-hmm. I mean, go out and enjoy our summer holidays. I just thought it was so lazy and hopeless.
We were all surprised when the first Downton movie came out, okay? And then that was it. They were definitely, that was the final movie, it was done. Then a second Downton movie came out, and then that was definitely it. They were finally done. And here we are. Are we finally done with this third Downton?
Ciara, I don't think so. Like, I was watching it. I think what they have done is they have tied up, like, if this is the final thing they ever do in this world, it's tied up perfectly enough for you. And it also leaves a little bit so you can go, oh, I wonder what happens when they go in this direction. But also, ka-ching, ka-ching, I wonder what happens when they go in this direction. Will they have, there's enough here, they've left enough of a carrot at the end to sort of go, will we actually do a spin-off show?
Well, that's
and bring
really
it back
the way
for
go,
a series,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Or will we come back and do another 90-minute special? I felt with this, I wouldn't go as far as Donald, and I have to say I didn't really watch the series, so I wasn't a massive fan. But I felt watching this felt like the fans wanted it, and the two fans I went with, they said they smiled the whole way through. So the fans are absolutely loving this, but it felt like for me this could have probably been a Christmas Day special.
Okay. All right. Now, Donald, there are many, many elements here. There's loads of subplots. There's loads of situations. What's going on? What's going on in this movie?
Well, there's no, I mean, it's funny. It goes on for a good, what, like 100
two
minutes?
Hours.
Too long.
Longer.
However long it is. But there's really no plot to speak of. What there is merely a situation, and that situation is passing time, which, by God, there are enough occasions in which they turn around and say, isn't it funny how things have changed? I mean, and that is represented by all these sort of thumping bits of exposition which will explain it to you, and also by a little degree of plot. So we know we're in the Depression, so times are hard, so they have to sell the London home. Lady Michelle Dockery, now divorced, is gently shunned in polite society, therefore demonstrating that though times have changed, they haven't changed that much. The most hilarious bad bits, I think, involve a visit to the house by Noel Coward. The first film aped the most famous episode of Upstairs, Downstairs, which 1970s series this owes an awful lot to, by having King George V come to visit, which was the most famous episode of Upstairs, Downstairs. I think what's happening here, and I'm pretty doing them a favour, is they're making a point a little bit ahead of time, you might argue, about celebrity being the new royalty. So Noel Coward arrives and they treat him with the kind of respect that two films ago they treated George V. But it is like, towards the end of that sequence, you get a scene which is very much like those awful biopics of musicians where they spot the name of their greatest hit on a billboard. Go, oh, Good Vibrations. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Private Lives, Noel Coward's most famous play. And he's talking about his plot for it, looks at Michelle Dockery and says, your private life. I felt sorry for them. I felt mortified for them.
Do you know what? Let's have a little bit of a listen to Downton Abbey. Much of this film, as you mentioned, is about downsizing. Lady Mary and Lord Grantham view a flat of all things.
When you took charge, there were emperors in Moscow, Vienna and Berlin. And your parents were king and queen of this part of the county. But that world is gone now. It's a different place.
So everyone keeps saying.
And it's not different because we can get to Cape Town in a few days instead of half a year. We're changing too. The way we talk, the way we dress, the way we deal with each other. This is Mary's time. She's in step with how to run this estate in the 30s, the 40s and the 50s.
And I'm not.
You know this system doesn't work if people hold on too long.
That was actually our own Alan Leach. He's back as a driver turned posh person, Tom Branson. And in that scene, he's encouraging his father-in-law, Hugh Bonneville's Lord Grantham, to modernise and to move on. What is Alan Leach's role? What's his situation in Downton now at this stage, Serena?
He's basically just merely a visitor. He's back with his daughter and he comes when, without giving too much away, he comes when times are really tough. And he seems to be the advisor in the family. That's his role, the negotiator, the one that sort of simmers everything that's going on. He does a really good job. There's not a lot for him to do, but what he does do is he does it well. And I have to say, the one thing about Downton Abbey, besides its gorgeous locations, the gorgeous fashion, the gorgeous jewellery, like that's a given. I have to say, this cast, as an ensemble cast, works really well. And ensemble casts don't always work well. There's always someone trying to grab attention and take attention away. I feel that none of them do that because they've been doing it for so long. They just bounce off each other perfectly.
There's a sense they like one another.
Exactly.
I will grant you that. I think that they play well against one another, and certainly kind of, you know, that the main cast, Hugh Bonneville in particular, have fallen into these roles and made them their own.
And we're talking about the cast, you know, a lot of them haven't graduated beyond this show, but then there's impressively big names here too. We've got Dominic West, Paul Giamatti and Simon Russell Beale. How do they add to the movie, or did they?
They're fine. I mean, again, the parts are so thin that there's not much for them to do. I mean, they're wheeled on and you recognise the fact that they have a celebrity and you knock that off the list of things that you have to do whenever you're returning to a property of this value. I think Simon Russell Beale is particularly ill-served, who's given a kind of Woodhouse-ian buffer, who is, you know, everything that's wrong with the old aristocracy. And here we have Hugh Bonneville, who now has reinvented himself as a new version of aristocracy, or more particularly Michelle Dockery has. And poor old Simon Russell Beale is stuck with this kind of crusty old cliche of the duffer who says all the wrong things and wants to go back to the old ways and all those things. And I'm sure he enjoyed himself. He's amongst friends. I'm sure he was well paid and there's a perfectly nice set and good catering. So I don't begrudge him the gig.
And we have to talk about the absence of Maggie Smith as the dowager duchess, and perhaps that loss underlines how much they relied on her for the humour in Downton.
But
she wouldn't have ruled them out of bringing her back. Because, the first film, they kind of sort of half said, oh, she's saying goodbye, and she turned up and went, I'm back! So I wouldn't have ruled it out.
I really do love the way they paid homage to her in this. I didn't feel like it was too over the top. I felt like even though she wasn't there, her presence was always there. And it's not giving anything away, but just that final shot, that final scene, I thought was just beautiful, the way they shot it. So, you know, even though, and was it, am I wrong in saying it was dedicated to her? There was something.
I think it was.
It
must have been.
Yeah.
It must have been.
I just think the way that they handled her not being there was so beautifully done, and all these, but it wasn't too over the top. I think You can tell Donald and I aren't fans of the of the series. I never got into the series. I thought this was a pleasant watch. I did feel like I was watching a very long TV episode. But if you're a fan, as I said, I went with two fans. They said they smiled the whole way through. So if you're a fan, this is a fitting farewell, and I think you'll enjoy it. Go see it. I mean, you know, we need things that make us happy, and if you're a fan, this will make you really happy.
Well, I think this will make you laugh because I really want to play this clip from the movie, and it, as you say, as we said, it is about downsizing. This is Lady Mary and Lord Grantham, and they're viewing a flat.
So this is how the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. What's that?
I don't know. The family upstairs.
The family upstairs? What about downstairs? Is a family there too?
I don't know if it's a family.
How peculiar. A sort of layer cake of strangers. And what about when I want to go up to bed?
You don't go up, you go along.
Extraordinary. Isn't it odd to live in a building full of strangers?
I just think that's brilliant. He wouldn't have done well in Dublin City in 2025, would he?
Not at all.
Okay, so how many stars, Donald? We'll start with you.
It brought out my inner Maoist. I'm giving one star to the running capitalist dogs. Oh, yes.
Oh, my.
Barely that.
Okay.
He's harsh, Kira. I'm going to give it. Can I give it two ratings? Can I give it mine and can I give it the fans?
Absolutely.
So I would give it a three. It was a pleasant enough watch, but I'm going to go with Rotten Tomatoes for once, because Rotten Tomatoes, critics gave it 91 and the audiences gave it 98. And the two that I were with were probably on that mark. So I'd say fans would give this 4.5. I will give this a 3.5, okay, only because I'm not a fan.
Okay, this sounds like it's just definitely one for the fans.
Definitely.
And let's move on to the next movie that we're going to talk about, Spinal Tap. Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. And I'm really worried about this because I loved this so much when I saw it. And, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Initially, the first one.
Yeah.
Sorry, the first one I'm talking about. So I'm always worried when a movie comes out and it's a continuation of something that was so loved by people in a particular time. Like lately, Happy Gilmore 2 came out. I don't know, did either of you see that?
Yeah,
you know, they should have just stayed, left it with Happy Gilmore. How does Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues compare with its 1984 predecessor? Donald, let's start with you.
Well, much better than I expected.
Okay.
The first thing that I would say is that I had a really nice time with this film. It's a funny concept because if you, I'll say this first, that if you talked to me 40 years ago, and I'm afraid you could have done that, I'm of an age where that would be possible, and said, what about the notion of having a sequel in 2025? And I think anybody would have said, well, it's preposterous, because look how many rock groups playing in their 60s, not to mention their 70s and 80s. And now we arrive in the era of, well, Paul McCartney, who is in this film and gives a very amusing extended cameo, has just 2 years ago headlined Glastonbury at the age of 80. Ozzy Osbourne, with Parkinson's, you know, played his last gig a few months before he died in his late 70s. So you have something that is actually worth satirizing in this. Now, I think that's the thing which works surprisingly well. I think the film is not hilarious. I mean, it's not kind of slap your thigh, fall off the seat hilarious the way your seventh or eighth or tenth viewing of This Is Spinal Tap still is. But what it is surprisingly good at, it's catching the poignancy of being that age and still trying to be young. And it actually allows him a certain amount of dignity despite that. I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon, is we just didn't think this was going to happen rock groups. And it has happened, and it's a real thing. And I think it treats that, I think, with surprising sensitivity.
And for those that haven't seen This Is Spinal Tap, what was that movie about?
It was about, well, the funny thing about it was about an aging rock group. I mean, that kind of, again, presses home the fact of how unexpected this development was, that people would still be playing at this age. They were at that stage, you know, around 40, I suppose, and they were an aging rock group, an aging heavy metal band who had started off as a skiffle group in the 1960s and were now on their last diabolical tour. I mean, there was a lot of parody in there. There was a lot of Let It Be in there, of the Beatles' Let It Be, of the arguments in the studios were all kind of referencing that. So it was utterly singular at that point, not least because, as we should point out, it's a mockumentary, as you might call them. I'm not saying it was the first ever mockumentary, but it was certainly the first to be a hit and the first I remember seeing. So it felt incredibly new and surprising at that point in 84. And it has spawned a whole industry of
mockumentaries. I'm a huge fan of the mockumentary. I really, really am. You're not so much, Serena?
So I think I got into it too late. And by too late, I mean Monday. I finally watched This Is Spinal Tap and I've heard so much about it. And I sat in and I watched the original and I went, okay, it's funny in parts, but I don't get it. Like even the, oh my God, help me. What's the... The big, this is really bad that I forgot.
Stonehenge.
That's part of the
Banshee's Howl.
Yeah, but see, even that, everyone was telling me, this is hilarious. And it got to that. I was like, oh, okay. But I'm glad I watched it because then I was able to enjoy the sequel. I have to say, you know what it's like when you go to a press screening. It's hard to gauge what the comedy is like because people sort of don't laugh or whatever. There are a lot of men at this press screening, and Kira, I have to say, I could feel the joy coming from the back of them. The amount of, I could hear Donald chuckle quite a few times watching it. I did enjoy the fact that Kerry Godleyman has joined the cast.
I love her. She's amazing.
Isn't she? And
I should say she's playing Ian Faith's daughter, yeah. And she's called Hope Faith, which is a good joke in itself.
But she was brilliant in Afterlife with Ricky Gervais. She played the wife. She is brilliant in this. For me, what made this so entertaining was the cameos. How, are we allowed to mention the
oh,
big
yes, names? I think.
So the fact that Paul McCartney and Elton John lent into this so much is what made me enjoy it. But I think, again, like we were talking about Downton Abbey, I think if you're a fan, you're going to walk away from this going, it's brilliant to have them back. I'm so happy. And again, I don't begrudge fans to go and actually watch and enjoy all of that because, we, as I said, we all need that bit of joy.
I think they're trying a good bit harder than they were in Downton Abbey. I also think it's worth pointing out that
I think there's bias there.
There is a degree of playing the old hits, literally playing the old hits in this case. But there is a good bit of like decent commentary on how things have changed and how things have got worse and maybe how things have got a bit better. Chris Addison, I think, is great as their current manager. And Ian Faith, Tony Hedra, who played him in the first film, was that kind of Peter Grant from Led Zeppelin type, the guy kind of wielding a cricket bat backstage. Now we have essentially a Simon Cowell type, which is a very different kind of energy.
Do you know what? Let's have a listen. Comedian Chris Addison is in this scene as a pure man with ideas on how to market them.
What we need to do is secure your legacy. If during the gig, at least one, but ideally no more than two of you, were to die, would you settle for a coma?
Oh, no, that's interesting.
You know?
That's a great bit of thinking outside, well, a literal box, I suppose,
That's very, very funny. Are there any moving moments in it?
I thought so, definitely. I mean, I won't give it away, but there's a bit towards it. Well, one of the ways the dynamic has changed is that Davidson Hubbins, lead singer and rhythm guitarist, and Nigel Tufnell, lead guitarist, are clearly... You know, they are so close. They can only the only way they can move forward is to end up hating one another. It's the nature of old friendships. And in the first film, it ended with a reconciliation after they fell out. And obviously, unsurprisingly, there's a little bit more of that here. But except there is this sense here that the reconciliation has to come quite quickly because how much longer do they have to reconcile? Which I thought was generally quite poignant, and it happens in a way that I think will prickle the eyes of a few old fans of Spinal Tap. I mean, it's a simple film, it's a small film. A lot of it takes place in one room. Obviously, they're of an age where they can't be kind of like, you know, falling down the stairs and doing whatever things they would have done in a more extravagant comedy. But I think in its small way, I think it works far better than I would have hoped or expected.
And the music scenes were quite fun as well. And I loved that there was a lot of nods to the original as well. So, like, while Fran Drescher isn't in it all the time, she was there. You know, there was Paul Schaefer as well.
The return by Janine, which I won't spoil, is great. Janine's return is excellent. You'll enjoy it.
and the drummer, and I cannot remember her name, but the addition of the new drummer was fantastic as well. So, look, I think there's a lot of fun to be had if this is what you're looking for and this is your thing. I think you need to see these things on the big screen as well. Don't be watching at home because the joy that comes from watching these things with an audience is what...
And the sound is much greener as the picture. I mean, when you hear those really quite good songs being blasted out again, it's a real treat.
And now the lads are going to make money from it as well. Not like they made hardly any money from the original.
From the first one, it's so funny because it was a bit, as you said, it had a cult following. Valerie Franco is the drummer.
She's brilliant.
Okay, guys, stars.
Four, comfortably.
Wow, four, brilliant.
I'll give it a three.
You'll give it a three. Okay, yeah. That is Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. Now, Donald, I want to talk to you about The Long Walk. Mm-hmm. Tell me, this is Stephen King's latest adaptation in the movie world. We've been here before with him. I mean, off the top of my head, The Green Mile, Pet Sematary, Misery. How does it hold up?
I think it's one of the best Stephen King adaptations in quite some time. And it's a peculiar one because it is the first book that he sat down to write 60 years ago. I mean, quite a few years before Carrie was eventually published and became a sensation and turned him into the phenomenon
Carrie
that he
as well.
Is now.
Every time you mention that there is another movie, yes. There is another Stephen King.
Yeah, well,
adaptation.
Carrie was both the first book and the first King adaptation.
Wow.
Both are excellent in their own ways. This didn't end up getting published until, I think, 1979, so a good decade after, and it was published under his pseudonym Richard Bachman. The Bachman books are published separately and in anthologies, I think. It's interesting in that a lot of people have been saying it's the kind of, I'm using a little cliche, it's more relevant than ever, which is some truth in that. I mean, it is America, the United States, we could argue, has never been closer to totalitarianism than it is currently. And this is a totalitarian dystopian story. The plot being that in the depression following the rise of a totalitarian government, totalitarian force taking over the country, we now have this race, this walking race, which people volunteer to join. They all feel obliged to volunteer. And there are, I think, 50 competitors who walk across a large portion of the United States. And if you fall behind, you get shot dead. If you break a whole other series of rules, you get shot dead. And the only person who wins any money at the end is the person left standing at the end. Now, I don't think they quite pull off the sense of doom that would bring to simple people in that situation. They're surprisingly jolly for people who know that they're almost inevitably going to die. But I think the tension is maintained quite well. What I thought was interesting about the scenario, which I wasn't aware of and hadn't read the book, is that it is looking forward, as all dystopias are to an extent, but it's also looking back. This strikes me, reminded me of nothing so much as the marathon dance contest that they used to have in the Depression in the United States in the 1930s, which were famously provided the basis for the film They Shoot Horses, Don't They? By Sidney Pollack in the 1960s. So I think King, being an educated man who thinks about these things, I think it was looking backwards as well as forwards. And I think it is a useful analogy, but more importantly than that, and this is surprising because the director, Francis Lawrence, who's made a few of the Hunger Games films, has a real challenge here because the whole film is essentially people walking and talking. They're on boring roads, walking through, I think it's Canada, it's shot in, but walking through the plains of the United States. And he gets by with that because it's got a strong plot, strong characters, and King was always good about defining characters by one or two traits. And good actors, I think. Cooper Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman's son, is great. And David Johnson, who I think is one of the best young British actors of the era, was great in a film called Rye Lane a few years ago. He's really good as his mate in this.
Okay. Okay, well, let's hear some of the participants in The Long Walk forming a bond. And among them, we will hear Cooper Hoffman as Raymond and David Johnson as Peter.
I like you. But if you fall over, I won't pick you up.
We're all in this together, right? No harm in keeping each other amused.
But you know what? I take it back. They say you shouldn't make friends on The Long Walk, but fuck it. I sort of like you three. Even you, Olsen.
Fuck off.
No, I'm serious. Hey. A short friendship is better than no friendship, right?
That's what I've been saying,
man. That's what I've been saying. Come on, man. Let's be musketeers.
How the fuck are we gonna be musketeers? There's four of us.
Come on, now. We stick together to where all that's left. How about that? All for one.
One for all.
Nah, and again, I need to hear it louder. All for one.
And one for all.
Hell yeah. Yeah, right? You know, yeah, not you.
Like, this seems like it's going to be a grim watch. Like, how graphic are the scenes?
Well, they're quite graphic, but they all involve the same thing, which is people being shot to death, which is done quite graphically, which in this week and of all weeks is something perhaps we find a bit uncomfortable. But it's not hugely graphic, no. It's not, a film like Weapons, for example, is out now. It's got a succession of quite gruesome scenes in it. So it's not hugely graphic, and the you can probably see the moments coming when it is going to be graphic. It is more of a drama, the kind of thing that you can see King being influenced by The Twilight Zone when he was writing it, which was still being fresh in his mind. It's that kind of quality of like one concept that they work, not to death, but they just work, the concept is strong enough, the high concept, to last the 90 minutes, if not much longer. And also there are always allegories floating around here. It's an allegory for capitalist America. It's an allegory for life itself. You know, at the end of it all, that you're going to get shot in the head.
And very quickly, I want to ask you, Mark Hamill is in this as well.
I wasn't all that happy with Mark Hamill in this film. I don't mind Mark Hamill, who we all grew up with him, but I think he's a bit miscast. He is the evil major, and I think it needs kind of a more kind of Stacey Keach or Robert Duvall presence in there rather than the slightly cuddly Mark Hamill. But it doesn't do anything to damage the film, which I think is a very efficient and effective film still.
So how many stars?
Four.
Four stars. Okay, so that was Downton Abbey, Spinal Tap 2 and The Long Walk. Thank you so much to Donald Clark and Serena Bellissimo for coming in to chat to me. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena with me, Ciara King. Now, writer Mick Herron is widely considered the heir to John le Carré, a contemporary master of spy fiction. He has redefined the genre with his award-winning novels about Slough House, where the slow horses of the MI5 are put out to pasture under the watchful eye of Jackson Lamb. Fans of Slow Horses TV adaptation will be looking forward to a new series later this month. And in the meantime, Mick Herron has just published Clown Town, his ninth novel from Slough House, one that harks back the Troubles and an IRA double agent. Declan Burke has been reading it for us and he's here with me now in studio. Declan, it's lovely to have you.
And it's good to be here, Ciara.
Now, Apple TV's hit series Slow Horses has brought these novels to a whole new readership. Let's hear the citizens of Slough House in action, including Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb and Jack Lowden as River Cartwright. Here they're looking at CCTV footage of an ex-service agent just before his untimely death. And as fans will know, there's a little bit of language with Jackson Lamb.
What am I looking at?
Soho Street cam footage.
This is Soho? But where's all the prostitutes and the junkies?
Soho's changed.
Shut up, Mike.
Marcus.
It'll take me 6 months to get your name right, and if I've done my job, you'll be long gone by then. It looks like he's heading for Maribyrn. Can you pick him up there? Where's he gone? We lost him.
We just need to switch to another camera.
Cause of death?
What's going on?
Ex-service agent found dead on a bus in Oxford Parkway. Just got the coroner's report.
Guy!
Heart failure.
It's bollocks.
Well, he was in his 60s, smoked, drank, probably on the cards.
I'll do all that. Look at me. I'm in my prime.
That was Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb, Christopher Chung as Raddy Ho, Cadiff Kerwin as Marcus Longwich, Jack Lowden as River Cartwright, and Rosalind Elazier as Louisa Guy. Slough House itself is a character in the novels. Can you set the scene for us?
Yeah, Slough House is an actual building, very decrepit building. It's called Slough House because it's so far away from Regent's Park, which is the MI5 headquarters in London. Now, Slough House is where those MI5 agents, the intelligence operatives, who have momentarily screwed up or just terminally dim, they're put out to pasture. That's why they're the slow horses, and they're sent to Slough House, where they're under the watchful eye of our friend Jackson Lamb. In one of the novels, Spook Street, actually, Mick Herron describes Slough House as the administrative oubliette of the intelligence service, and those who are working there are given all their rubbish jobs. They're sifting through millions of emails, they're looking for subversive activity in people's rubbish bags and so forth. It's all a million miles, Ciara, from the kind of glamour we expect from spy fiction, which is kind of what Mick Herron is getting at with the whole series.
And even in this book as well, some of the descriptions about Slough House, if there were a lift, it would have long stopped working. If there was hope, it would have left. And my favourite in the book was Slough House, like a broken mouth, was full of gaps. You know, his description is absolutely incredible. So let's kind of set the scene. So you're over at MI5 in Regent Park. You've got the icily brilliant Diana, and she holds sway as first desk. Tell us a little bit about the bind in which Diana finds herself as Clown Town begins.
Yeah, so recently over the course of the series, Diana Taverner has become first desk at MI5. She is in charge. It's taken her a long time to get there. Icily brilliant is the phrase you use. I totally agree. I can imagine her as a child in the 80s looking on with astonishment and awe at Margaret Thatcher in Downing Street. So she has finally achieved that position, but the book opens with her being blackmailed. Not her so much as MI5 itself. ex-agents who worked on Operation Pitchfork, which occurred during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, they are blackmailing MI5 to reveal the details of what they were forced to do. They were effectively shielding or protecting an IRA enforcer who was a psychotic murderer, in effect. And this will look very bad to MI5 if it comes out. Someone will probably have to fall on their sword. Diana, it's not going to be her. There's also a personal blackmail against her made by Peter Judd, who is a kind of slimy politician. He's former Home Secretary. Whether Mick Hearn has based him on a recent British Prime Minister is for Mick Hearn to say. We're not in a position to say that. But he is blackmailing Diana because he has personal information on her. He has backers in the Far East, and he is looking for Diana to bring to basically put her imprimatur on Britain's support for certain territorial issues that are being decided in the South China Sea. So she finds herself in a double bind. She is not for turning, and she sees this as an opportunity, and she is going to throw some expendable slow horses at the problem.
And can we assume that she has asked permission of her old foe, Jackson Lamb, to co-opt his agents?
Yes, you and I both know that we cannot assume that, Ciara.
Absolutely
of course not. So there's a number of recurring characters. We heard Jackson Lamb on the clip. He is the central character around which all the novels, they revolve. Deliciously described in the novel Slough House as looking like a bin bag someone had set fire to, which is lovely. Yes, no, he's a belching, farting, swearing slot of a man. He's all about low cunning rather than high principles. And the relationship between Diana and Jackson Lamb is one of kind of grudging respect. They both respect one another's territories, even if they don't respect one another. But there is enmity between them.
They need each other.
They do. And they're useful to one another. So when Lamb discovers that Diana has gone behind his back and is effectively using his slow horses, his Joes, as he refers to him as, he kind of goes off the rails, because if anybody is throwing his Joes to the wolves, it'll be Jackson Lamb himself. That's how he likes to operate.
Now, I found that it's very hard to watch this. This is the first book that I've read by Mick Hearn. So, and I was very late to Slow Horses as well. I only watched all four series this summer because people were telling me, you have to watch Slow Horses, you have to watch Slow Horses. I wish, obviously, after reading this Clown Town, that I'd read the books first, all right? And it's very hard to read the book but not hear the characters' voices and see them in your head.
Yeah, and to be fair, that is partly because the TV series has so accurately portrayed the characters. They've obviously worked very closely with Mick Hearn. They've obviously read the novels very, very closely. And it's a testament to the TV makers. They've stayed so faithful to the source material. What I would say to you or anybody else who has kind of not read the novels yet or only read one, like John le Carré, and we might talk a little bit about him later on, you can reread John le Carré for the quality of the prose, for the quality of the characterizations, even if you know what the plot is. And so even if you have seen one of the TV shows, it's a very easy thing to go back and read a novel that provides the source material for those TV shows.
I was so surprised. It was Jackson Lamb, because I thought, oh, you know, he won't be like Gary Oldman, perhaps. And then within the first three or four pages, I went, oh my goodness, he's exactly like he is portrayed, you know, in the TV show. I want to talk about the historical backdrop to Clown Town now, because it's in the conflict in Northern Ireland and the MI5 colluding in murders committed by an IRA double agent. How well does Mick Hearn kind of fare dealing with recent Irish history? Because he tends to stick with Britain.
He very much does so. Like in the past, he's written about the rise of the far right in Britain, the privatisation of British intelligence, assassinations on British soil made by bad actors operating out of Moscow. And as you said, this one is set in... Well, it's rooted in the Troubles, if you can put it this way, revolves around Operation Pitchfork. Now, Mick doesn't take us back to the Troubles, which I was kind of slightly surprised by. None of the novel is actually set in Northern Ireland. What he's more interested in here is how those agents who prosecuted Operation Pitchfork were treated subsequently by MI5. And we realise that they have essentially been cast aside and treated very, very badly because, you know, they were just disposed of. It was a dirty stain on MI5. Nobody wanted for that, you know, kind of information to come out. The agents who are doing the blackmail, they're not operating out of any kind of moral or ideological instinct. They've been cut loose. They are financially destitute. Some of them are living on the street. They've been traumatised by the experience of Operation Pitchfork. And that's what Mick is much more interested in investigating. And that tracks with the progress of the novels over the last 8 or 9 novels, because the history isn't irrelevant, of course, but it's only pertinent to the extent that it creates the conditions by which how the British intelligence service looks after its own, compared to how maybe it used to maybe 30, 40, 50 years ago. And in the current instance, it's very, very badly. So this is how he brings to, it's a very caustic kind of satire he's bringing to bear.
And where does the Slough House series stand with respect to like the great British spy thrillers of the past?
For me, it's very much entitled to be in the conversation. We're talking about John le Carré, Len Dayton, even Graham Greene and his spy novels. They all were writing spy novels in order to chart Britain's decline on the international stage. And Mick Hearn is doing something very, very similar. They're not just spy thrillers. They're very funny. You've read this one. Anyone who's seen the shows will probably agree. Maybe not for the more sensitive, but certainly they are very, very funny. As I say, it's all about in these novels, in Mick Hearn's novels, by comparison with the others, the action is all taking place on British soil. The battle lines are drawn in Britain and sometimes between opposing intelligence services, sometimes between the Slough House, Slough Horses. Say that 3 times out loud. But essentially what he's trying to do is follow in the footsteps of John le Carré and chart that decline by examining how well or otherwise the British intelligence services are functioning.
I'm looking forward to going back to the start. And obviously everyone could look forward as well to the 5th series of Slough Horses, which will begin on Apple TV on September 24th. Thank you so much, Declan Burke, for coming in to chat to me. Mick Hearn's Clantown is published by Baskerville. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Now, if we cast our minds back to that truly dreadful time of COVID, we weren't allowed to see each other. We could not visit loved ones or commune or talk or hold hands. And the playwright and filmmaker Carmel Winter's mother was in a nursing home, and Carmel was forbidden from visiting her and had to rely purely on phone calls to remain in contact with her beloved mother in the short time she had left on this mortal coil. And now Carmel has made a film about losing her mother slowly over time. It's called The Art of Loss, and it's going to be shown as part of the IFI Documentary Festival this Saturday. And I'm delighted that Carmel Winters joins me now from her home in the beautiful West Cork.
Thank you, Ciara. I'm sitting out in the garden looking at all the trees being moved by the wind, so I'm right in the middle of it.
And in stunningly beautiful West Cork as well, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's I'm very lucky that at a time like lockdown, I was really in a place where you'd be blessed to be at a time like that.
And you know,
I suppose.
And at first, I want to say to you that I am so sorry for the loss of your mother as well. And I was wondering if you could bring us back to 2020 when we all went into lockdown. Your mum was in a nursing home. And as we know, you weren't allowed to visit. And that must have been dreadful for you and for her and everyone involved.
Yeah. I mean, she'd only just gone into the nursing home 2 or 3 days before lockdown. So the timing was catastrophic, really. But I think, you know, in the very early days, people thought this might be a couple of days thing. But of course, as we now know in hindsight, it was far from that. So she, like so many others, I don't feel at all alone in this. I couldn't visit her, and I did my absolute best to bend that rule. I did everything I could to try and get in or get her out, but I failed. So I really did only have the phone. So I would use the phone. I would let her know that I would stay on the other end of the line, even if she fell asleep, because she really didn't like being alone. And I would be out walking my dogs a lot because, you know, what else could I do? So I'd be out walking my dogs on the beach, and I'd let her know I was bringing her to the beach, and I would kind of paint the scene and try and bring her imaginatively with me wherever I was going, whether that was the beach or the forest. And while I was out with the dogs, I suppose as part of that, I felt I could listen to her better if I was taking pictures of what was in front of me, as if I was kind of memorializing almost these moments. And also, I don't know if this is common to other people, but sometimes at extreme times, I think we see the world differently. So, and for me, that meant I actually developed a really acute responsiveness to light and beauty, especially, but all of the wonders of nature, I suppose, because we need them most, you know, when the chips are down. I think sometimes that's when we're most alive to the wonders of nature. So I started photographing around me, and that kind of out of that grew the kind of genesis of this film, okay. Which was what I was looking at, what I was bringing my mother through imaginatively while talking to her on the phone.
All right. Well, why don't we have a listen to a little bit of the documentary? Here, Carmel talks to her mother on one of her dog walks.
Home movie.
It is a home movie. It's Carmel. Is that Carmel?
It's me. I'm here, Mammy.
I thought I might have dialed the wrong number. I can't see the numbers. I can't reach my glasses.
Is there no one there to help you?
I never see anyone.
Did you ring the bell?
I did. I ring the bell all day and all night. No one ever comes.
Hold on, Mammy. I'll ring them. I'll call you back.
No. Don't bother. I have you now. Where are you?
I'm out walking the dogs. We're at the beach. The sun is shining here. Is the sun shining there?
I don't know. The curtains are closed.
I'll get them to open the curtains, Mammy.
Carmel, are you gone?
I'm not. I'm still here.
I was thinking Easter would be a good time to die.
Would it?
Yeah, I think I'll die at Easter, if that's all right with you.
It is. Sure, if it's all right with you, Mammy, it's all right with me.
Now, Carmel, how can you describe this film? It's an imagined conversation with your mother. So all the things that were going through your head.
Well, it starts with real conversations, which I reconstruct. And then as my mother passed, imaginatively, I kept the conversation going with my mother. So I'd be on the same walks and I would still hear her voice and I would still converse in my mind with her. I suppose that's the playwright in me doing that. And what you heard at the top of that clip there were my two dogs. So my two dogs became almost like a Greek chorus, or like in the Muppet Show, the two old lads in the box commenting on everything. So what you heard there was one dog, Lucky, who talks like this, and my other little dog, Habibi, who's more like this, talking about what she sees. So they sort of cut up. In a way, that came out of the fact that during lockdown, I would make talking dog videos for people just to bring a little moment of joy or amusement or pleasure or connection, into our lives. And I said, well, as I was doing that during that time, I should bring that into the film. And it also allowed the dogs to be a little bit more kind of humorous and tongue-in-cheek about the process of grieving itself. Mm-hmm. I suppose sometimes they have a kind of a cheekier perspective than I might have. But also it's part of the fact, it reflects that after my mother died, my little dog Habibi was killed, and I grieved her totally differently.
Well, tell
to
me,
my mother.
Because sometimes people find it easier to grieve a pet, as it's, I guess, less complicated in some ways. How did you react?
I would say I actually found it harder in that I was so... I mean, I think it's a longer journey with a parent. It's a lifetime journey. But I was glad. My mother was afraid of dying. So actually, this will sound strange, but I was glad when she made it. It felt like she had to really labor hard to die. And that when she got through to the other side, I was just glad her suffering was over. I was so glad for her that suffering had ended. Whereas she lived a tremendous life and the last years were hard. But, you know, a lot of her life was very joy-filled, and she had a certain gusto for life. So when that died away before she died, you know, I think it is a natural part of life dying is so much a natural part of all of our journeys. And I did try, and I made friends with her dying in order to be able to be a calm presence with her, alongside her through it. Whereas when my little dog was killed, she had been my little consort in the grieving of my mother, and she was killed unexpectedly on the street at a friend's funeral. And
oh my gosh.
I I mean, I felt it was maybe more obviously catastrophic. And I did wonder if the kind of, there was no, oh, I'm glad her suffering is over, which is a huge relief when you see someone suffering and you know they're suffering. But yeah, with her, I felt it was a very different kind of journey, and it became part and parcel, as my mother says in the film, and she's talking to me after she has died. She says, "You miss your little dog more than you miss me." And I kind of say, well, I don't know where one loss ends and the other begins.
Yeah. Why don't we have a listen? This is Carmel and her mother discussing her dog, Habibi.
Habibi, come here, darling. Come here, sweetheart.
Is that Arabic, Habibi?
Did you eat it?
Yeah. It means beloved.
She's like you when you were small, with her curls. Are you sorry you don't have kids?
A lot of kids in my life.
Of your own, I mean. You and Tama. Sorry. Is that a faulty question?
And I want to talk about as well how beautiful West Cork looks in this documentary. You feature footage, obviously, of your daily dog walks. Was it on these walks that you talked to your mother, or was it after her death? So it was, okay.
Yeah, I did. I mean, the film is almost exactly before she died. It's exactly what happened and how we would have spoken to each other, you know. And there was a little, we did have a little, I was very lucky in that we were able to talk about her death. And then I just continued it afterwards. I kept talking to her in my mind. And then I just started repeating those conversations. And I felt like, even now, I feel like I could slip into letting my mother speak through me, because I suppose being a playwright, that's what you do. You let people speak through you, as it were. But I have the gift of feeling like, as her daughter, I'm part of her. So as I said to her, one of my last conversations with her is like, well, you live on forever in me. Mm-hmm. You can't die while I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
no, go on. Sorry, Carmel.
Because it's interesting, you know, only having the phone, a lot of the time I was just listening to her breathing, especially while she was sleeping. And I feel very lucky to have kind of internalized her breath. It felt like really taking in her spirit.
Absolutely.
I suppose that's my imagination, if you like. But what else do we have an imagination for except to make life, you know, to enhance our experience of this time on this planet.
Absolutely. And again, I want to, can you describe to people the imagery of West Cork that you used in the documentary?
Well, a lot of it was extraordinary light shows, you know, when the sun would be piercing through these dark clouds and splitting into absolute rainbows. And then hitting the water and like all these sparks of light, where it feels like you're witnessing pure spirit itself in the landscape. Or other times I would be lying out in the bath and we just threw a bat up in the hub of a tractor wheel and put a fire into it, and I would be lying out in a bath full of moss and leaves and just literally imagining these conversations with my mother continuing after death as before in life.
Okay. Well, Carmel, has it helped you? You know, has this whole process been therapeutic for you?
I think having time to show up to grief is a privilege and a gift that I'm very grateful for. But I wouldn't recommend filmmaking as a therapeutic activity in and of itself. You know what I mean? But I'm glad that I've distilled all that time into a short piece that has kind of all the tones, the joys, the sorrows, the humour, the meaning. I'm glad I've distilled something for myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carmel, thank you so much for chatting to me and Irina tonight. That was Carmel Winters. The Art of Loss will be shown as part of the IFI Documentary Festival this Saturday afternoon at 2:10. And it'll be followed by a Q&A with Carmel and Lenny Abramson. So for more details, the website is ifi.ie/docfest. That is all we have time for this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman and researched by Leah Murphy. Ollie Hamilton was our broadcast coordinator, and Paul Murnock was on sound.